domino, on the spot a few black for hands, domino, on the spot a few black for hands.
Hello everyone, I am your host Robert Stevens and this is the Black Work Experience Podcast. As you may know, I started this podcast because I was tired of being the only black male or one of the few black people at my organizations. This can be crazy. I was constantly called upon to speak for the black experience or expected to do the emotional labor after blatantly racist things occurred. This is heavy, and it left me feeling fragile, unappreciated, and in need of a change. I began to ask my friends if they ever experienced being the only one or one of the few people of color at their job and the impact it had upon them. We discussed what it felt like to experience microaggressions and not have a friend or ally to lean on. Balancing the thin line between needing your coins and not being tokenized is never easy. The Black Work Experience explores the intersection between race, class, and privilege in America and in the workforce. We tell the stories of those who paved and are currently paving the way. As people of color gain more institutional, political, and economic power, we often find ourselves surrounded by people who do not look like us, talk like us, or even think like us. This podcast discusses what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who feel alone. I fully recognize that not all black people think alike. The stories we share on this podcast may seem foreign to you and your experience. However, a lot of black people experience microaggressions daily, and we need an outlet. This is your outlet. I want you to know that you are not alone. This podcast is for all people, but we focus heavily on black people. I want you to know that you're not the only one experiencing microaggressions, otherness at work, and potential loneliness. If you identify with majority culture, listen to the podcast. Think about how you can help your black colleagues when your coworker talks over them or runs to the manager instead of having a difficult conversation or even calls them intimidating. Lean in, listen, and learn. That's what we're asking of you. Guess what time it is? You guessed it. It's mail time. We had a lot of submissions for mail time this week. I want to encourage you all to keep them coming. But I want to highlight this one from Ify Walker. She's a prior guest on the show. Ify is the CEO of Ofer, which is a talent matching company and also a personal hero of mine. And this is entitled, Dear Black Women, the silence of all the education Amy Coopers who name us as friends in the company of another black person and who know that they have, could, and will professionally George Floyd us is so loud that I can hear it all the way in the back where the value statements are painted. The endless strategic plans are churned out by handsomely paid Amys, paid to add new words to old problems and offer talking points, decks, and sound bites, paid to ignore your ideas or claim them as your own, call your boss or board instead of talking to you directly, pitch a tantrum if you are promoted and they were not, while labeling the black person who speaks up as unprofessional and not a team player. So, for now, seek joy in whatever way you can, for joy is a revolutionary act. Have an indoor snowball fight with your children. Lean out at work. Turn off social. If Amy's nonsense is on level 32 today, you don't have to respond. Your self-preservation is primary. Plot your escape. Read a trashy book. Take a walk and put your sunglasses on. Cry. Turn off the Zoom camera. Get a financial advisor. Unfollow and block. Laugh loudly. No is a sentence and an answer. Ify drops so many gems. Make sure you all follow her on LinkedIn. Look her up. I think that mail time speaks for itself. Let's jump into it.
Hello again, and we want to just say thank you all for listening once again to the Black Working Experience podcast. I'm super excited about the guest we have today, Nigel Austin, a gentleman who has been foremost and and a formidable person in my life in terms of my development. Since 2007, 2008, he served as a mentor for me and just has a wealth of experience. Chairman, I call him Chairman, so you may hear me refer to him as Chairman. We want to just say thank you for joining us again, and we want to get right into it. So, Chairman, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You know, who are you? Where are your origins, and what do you do now?
Well, I'm Nigel Austin. I was born and raised in, or reared in, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I attended Livingstone College and came back to work here in 1974 when I graduated. Currently, I am the executive director of the North Carolina Black Repertory Company, which is the producer of the National Black Theater Festival.
That is amazing. I think that when I think about you and your experiences, I know that you've had a lot of different professional experiences. I know you mentioned that you are the executive director of North Carolina Black Repertory Company. And what other professional experiences have you had?
Well, Terrell, I started work at Intergon, which became GMAC Insurance, 2 weeks after I graduated in 1974. So I graduated on May 14th. It'll be 4 to 6 years next week. And started 2 weeks later on May 28th. I worked there for 36 years, unlike that many people will work that long in one place. During that time, I also became very engaged in the community and decided to take the Dale Carnegie course. And after going through that and being a graduate coach, I became a trainer, Dale Carnegie certified trainer in 1992. And so I've been doing that now for 28 years. Additionally, I've had some other experiences. I worked at your alma mater for a couple of years after leaving GMAC as director of community engagement, employee engagement, government relations, and marketing and communications. I've been an interim position on a couple of occasions. I was the interim executive director of the North Carolina Black Repertory Company before making that position permanent. Now it's part-time. And was also interim director of the Department of Social Services while they were searching for a new director about 6 years or so ago. And there are a number of other experiences in terms of nonprofit and volunteering, et cetera, and serving on boards and other things of that nature. But in terms of work experience, that would outline it.
You know, I'm hearing you talk about all the things that you've been able to do. And since I've known you, you know, you've been exceptionally successful, someone that I've tried to mirror my own life and success around. I want to ask you a question. In all of these positions that you just, you know, mentioned, have you ever experienced the imposter syndrome? I know we spoke to some other individuals, and I know I've experienced it myself, where sometimes I have to act like, do I really belong here? You know, like I'm leading in these organizations, I'm here, but do I really belong here?
I've never really questioned whether I belonged. I felt that I belonged. Like you, I attended an HBCU where I was nurtured. I was brought up in a family where I felt like I could do whatever I set my mind to do. So in terms of not belonging, I haven't necessarily felt that. Now, have there been challenges and have there been barriers? Yes. Part of the imposter syndrome is feeling like you're a fraud or you don't know what you're doing. And that experience or feeling I haven't had. Now, there have been a couple positions with Department of Social Services and initially as the interim director for the North Carolina Black Repertory Company, where it was outside of what my experience was. However, I had transferable skills and in terms of what the role was to be. I didn't have a question about whether I could do what needed to be done during that period of time.
Okay. No, that makes sense. And I think one thing that we see and, you know, one thing that we hear about a lot when we talk to, like, young professionals, particularly black people who are coming up, that, like, they do feel that level of imposter syndrome. And I think what you just said makes a lot of sense. It's not that you are a fraud as much as it is the fact that there may be some skills that are transferable and maybe outside your comfort zone, but you belong. You always felt that you belonged, and I think that that's important. How did your experience at that HBCU, you think, contribute to you not having that imposter syndrome? You say you felt nurtured and developed at your HBCU.
Exactly. You know, it's particular for me. It was a smaller institution, so there were about 1,000, 1,100 students. But at an HBCU, it's a different experience. It's a different relationship that you form. There are people that look like you. There are professors and others that care about you and that push you and encourage you. As, for example, and I may have shared this with you before, Terrell, I had a professor. Her name was Abna Lancaster. She was my English professor. I went to Livingstone on a football scholarship, and honestly, I was not applying myself the way I should have that first semester. And after the semester was over with, I distinctly remember in the spring of the year, she walked past me, and I'm sure you and or your listeners may have experienced this, where you're driving somewhere and it seems like the police comes right out of your trunk and they're right there on top mm-hmm. of you. She literally was behind me. I didn't know it. She walked up beside me. She touched me on my shoulder. And she looked at me and she said, "Mr. Austin, football season is over with. You can do better." She kept walking and never said another word. For me, that was just a moment of inspiration. You know, put on your best shoes when you go in. Make sure you dress appropriately and do your work. And from that point on, I applied myself in a different way because, one, she expected it, and, two, there was not a lot of complaining or fussing about it. It was just very directly, you can do better. And so I performed. So for me and for a number of people that I went to school with, that was that feeling of you had to perform. You knew you were just as good as anyone else. You knew that there were going to be obstacles. We are Black. We know what that experience means. We know that we have to operate in multiple cultures. We have to be bilingual, as we say, in a way, and not so much speaking a foreign language, but being able to assimilate and continue to be yourself at the same time. So that preparation assisted in terms of just knowing that you could do it, number one, knowing that there were going to be some barriers, and you just had to navigate through it and persist.
That makes a lot of sense. You brought up something that really made me think about, like, your identity. You know, you talked about going to an HBCU. For those the listeners who don't quite understand, HBCU stands for Historically Black College or University. Chairman attended Livingstone College. I attended Winston-Salem State University. Both of those schools have had, you know, immense impact upon both of us. But let me ask you this: how has your racial identity impacted your professional career? Like being Black, how has being Black impacted you?
Well, one, again, the things that we know because we've had those conversations with our parents or with others since childhood. So there's some things that you understand and you realize that standards may be different. You realize because you're a different hue or a different ethnicity that there are going to be challenges. You realize that you might have to work twice as hard. So for me, again, being grounded in who I am and having been encouraged and knowing that I can do the job, part of the impact has been an increased awareness of my actions. You know, people are looking at you. And depending on how you perform, that might impact the next person that comes after you or the next Black person or African-American that is hired. So it increased my awareness of me and what I do to ensure that I was doing things in the right way and the possible impact that might have on someone else that might follow me or come after I've entered into the workplace in terms of what the expectations might be. And particularly coming from historically Black college or university, when the perception of those may be different than those that come from PWIs or predominantly white institutions. The other part of it in terms of impact is just the importance of preparation and performance, is that you know you have to perform. You know that you need to be prepared in order to do that, in order to have a chance in spite of the things that may present themselves in terms of barriers or challenges.
No, that's real. You, I think about my racial identity, you know, for the most part, like, I've always been the only black male or one of the few black people, period, at almost every job that I've had. Initially,
right.
You know, I think that it's been incumbent upon me to do my level best to change that. I never forget being in Dallas, Texas, and hearing Bishop Freddie Haynes. He came and spoke at an Urban League meeting, and he said something that always resonated with me. And you know, it was the Urban League Young Professionals, so the YP meeting. So these were individuals like the black professional class in Dallas, Texas. And he said, hey, when you get these positions, you may be the only one who looks like you. He said, but
correct.
You need to be a wedge. He said, you need to walk through the door, and you need to wedge yourself in the door so that they can't close it behind you. You need to keep that door open, and you need to pull as many of us right along with you as you can. Like, that is your,
correct.
He said, that is your call. That is what you are called to do as you enter in and work at these organizations. And so that has always resonated with me. So I think personally, like, my racial identity has impacted my professional career in a lot of different ways, because I've always felt called to make sure I wasn't the only one. I think sometimes it's difficult, though, Chairman, right, because I feel like I'm called to speak on behalf of, like, the black community, being the only person at my job. Have you ever, like, felt the pressure to do that, or felt like you represented, you know, that's like everyone? I know you mentioned that a little bit. Do you think of a time where that may have happened in your career and how you handle that?
Well, I think there's a certain, in particular in situations that you've been in, and we've had a number of conversations around it, it can become overwhelming at times to feel that you have the weight of so many others based on the interaction you have with someone. And that can be a daunting task. I don't know that I really felt that pressure, even though I was aware of it. And to your point about being a wedge, I think historically for us, whether it's in the workplace or anywhere else, it's important for us to have a voice where we are and to ensure that that voice is heard in a way that we can make a difference. And for me personally, my framework in terms of operating, and I've said this many times, you and I have had many conversations about it, we drink from a well that we did not dig. And it's incumbent upon us to continue to ensure that those that come after us also have some water to drink. And what I mean by that is there are a number of people that came before I came, that came before you came, and it's important for us to reach back and to be able to help them. And ways in which we do that is we mentor others, we reach out to others and help them in terms of what they shouldn't do or should do. We're a voice when we're at the table. As you know, if you aren't at the table, you can't make a difference. You can't influence anything. And so when you are at the table or you do have those conversations, you're a voice. When you are talking to others, and I've had others within my network and my relationships outside of where I work that I could reach out to talk about those experiences. You and I do this all the time. And
yes,
based on that input and feedback, then that helps to navigate or work your way through certain situations or decide that you want to make a change. So to me, it's important wherever we are to reach back and to help others, and we do that in a number of ways, and to be a voice, not only for ourselves and what we're doing and our well-being, but for others who may come after that.
Chairman, you said something that really and truly just resonated with me. We drink from a well we did not dig.
Correct.
That is, I think that's powerful right there. We did not
reach wherever we are on our own only. And for some who look like us or not, they aren't a voice for others, and they aren't reaching back to help others because they feel they've done it and they've earned it, and they're looking for themselves and it's independent. And the truth of it is we're all interconnected. And if we don't help each other, we don't make it.
That is so true. And I just recorded another episode, and it was with a doctor who's on the front lines of COVID-19. And one thing that he mentioned, he said two things that I think tie back to this conversation. The first thing that he mentioned was something very similar to you, just like the importance of mentors, people who have shaped and impacted him, you know, professionally and positively. And he said one thing that he doesn't see as much in our community, you know, is the sharing of those sort of resources in terms of, like, mentorship. And he mentioned specifically, you know, he wanted to be a doctor. He was coming from inner city New Jersey, and he did not necessarily have the network, or his family didn't have the network to connect him to other doctors. So when he said, hey, you know, I wanted to be a doctor, like, he had to go out and find individuals himself. And one thing he mentioned was a lot of sometimes he talked to friends and, you know, listen to them, and these are white friends and white people he met in med school. Was like, oh, you know, I wanted to be a doctor. I told my dad, and my dad, you know, put me in contact with his friend who was a doctor. So how do you think, I know you mentioned the educator who, the English teacher professor who said, you know, football season is over, you can do better. How have mentors impacted you?
Well, they significantly impacted me. You know, the list is longer than the opportunity we have for this particular podcast today. But it's important to have people, one, who know more than you, who have experience that you don't have, who might be in positions that you haven't attained at this particular time, that, one, you can trust and you can reach out to and will share information with you. I've shared this with you on more than one occasion, and your listeners, I hope, are not offended by what I'm about to say, but I think everyone needs to have some booger-nosed friends. And what I mean by that, and I think everyone would know about that, some people can look at you and see something and they won't tell you, and others will say, Terrell, you know, you've got something hanging out your nose. Mm-hmm. You need people to be able to look at you and tell you the truth. And I have, or had, three of those. One is now deceased. The other two are, one's in Louisville, Kentucky, a professor at the University of Louisville, and the other's a retired executive at what was Wachovia. And so those are people that it doesn't matter what time of day it is, what the question is, what the circumstance is, I know I can call, I can share what's going on, I can ask questions, I get feedback, I know that they will hold me accountable, and they don't care whether my feelings are hurt or not. This is the deal, this is what you need to do, and they will follow up. So it's very important to have mentors, and, you know, that relationship is one in which, and, you know, you and I have had conversations now for 13 years. And
yep.
It's you know, there's almost never a month that goes by that we don't have a conversation, and usually it's initiated about 11:45 or midnight, on the night. So I know when the telephone rings at that time, it must be Terrell. The first thing my wife says, is that Terrell? Yes, it is. You know, and so that relationship is not one where you're telling someone what to do, but providing some guidance and helping people to discover what they need to do and make some decisions and continue to learn and go forward. And that relationship helps not only in terms of that, but in terms of who you might connect with, or maybe you should talk with this person. Give them a call, tell them I said you should call them, and they will help you. And so the strength of those relationships and the mentorship helps in terms of just being able to navigate or understand what to expect or how you might, or what steps, for example, you might need to take next.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes sense. I think back, you know, it's so interesting, some of the similarities. You know, the listeners should know that I lost my dad in February 18, 2011. And I used to get so angry at my dad because I would ask him for advice. And, you know, Jeremy, I share this with you. My dad was a pastor for 35 years, and I asked him for advice. My dad would give me a little tidbit, right? Nothing too strenuous, a little tidbit. But then my dad would always ask me, say, son, Lean not to thine own understandings. In all thy ways, acknowledge the Lord, and he shall direct thy path. And
sure.
I used to get so upset because I just want him to say, hey, son, this is what I would do, or this is what you should do. And he would never do it. And then when, you know, my father passed, okay, I mean, you've really taken a father role in my life. I very rarely make any decisions without consulting you, any major decisions, whether that's job. You know, we had the conversation before I decided to get married to my wife. Just like, you've just always been a part. But I think my dad was preparing me for the relationship that I was going to have with you, because you in turn very suddenly tell me, hey, this is what I would do. You always ask questions and help me arrive at my own decision point, and I'm exceptionally grateful for that. And I think about the role that mentors have played in my life. I think that I am as successful as I am. A large part of that goes to the fact that I've had great people around me, those booger nose friends who would tell me that I have a booger in my nose, or who would tell me, hey, you know, your breath stinks right now, right? Like those people are
exactly.
Having conversations with you. So I think that that's super important. I want to switch the conversation a little bit, turn the tide, because, you know, the Black Work Experience, we dive deep into issues race, racism, and microaggression. And I'm thinking about the time that we're in, just thinking about how relevant this is. You know, a lot of my friends are down in Brunswick, Georgia right now because, you know, what happened in Georgia with the black runner, Ahmaud, who was running, and individuals down there got in the truck. Three white individuals got in the truck, saw him running in the neighborhood, thought that he was someone who had been burglarizing the neighborhood, ended up following him, chasing him, and confronting him and murdering him. And a large part of that can be attributed to, like, bias, right? Like, the bias that they had. You know, we've talked about your ability to, like, navigate a wide array of professional jobs. How have you seen, like, racism show up in the workplace?
Well, as you know, it shows up in so many different ways. I was looking over the questions that you sent to me, I thought about when I was interviewing for the position at Intergon when I graduated from school. So I applied, and at that time, a lot of businesses were big on management trainee programs. It was kind of in the day of beginning of affirmative action, if you will. And I remember going to Intergon in the spring of the year. I was late in the process of interviewing. And I probably had four or five interviews on that particular day, and I'll never forget the gentleman who was the head of claims. I worked for an insurance company. And as we were going through the interview, he was asking questions similar to yours, you know, who are you, where did you grow up, your family, et cetera. And I was explaining to him that my father was the first African-American deputy sheriff hired in Forsyth County. And as we continued through the interview, he continued to say, well, maybe your father could help you get a job. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm sitting here interviewing for a job, and you continue to tell me about my father and maybe he could help me. Now, eventually, I did get the job. There were five individuals who were hired to participate in the management trainee program. I was the only African-American. Others went to schools like Wake Forest University, UNC Chapel Hill, North Carolina State, and I went to a small private church-supported HBCU, Livingstone College. But I never felt that I couldn't compete with anyone else, regardless of where they went to school. And so that's a form of it, whether it was intentional or not, or there was a blind spot, which I think a number of majority population has or have blind spots that they don't see. They don't know that they don't know. They don't understand the privilege that they have, and therefore what's normal for them is not normal for everyone else because they've had that experience, and they have not had to experience some of the things that we've had to.
I think that hit the nail on the head. But I have a good friend who, a white guy, amazing. We've been friends since 2014, so 6 years now. And he said something to me when we were living in Dallas. He said, you know, He said, Terrell, I need you to tell me when I'm doing something wrong, because the same systems that create my privilege also allow me to not see my privilege.
Correct.
And I think that always resonated with me. That always resonated with me. So I think, like, being that first or that only one at Intergon, Intergon, which was prior to GMAC, what toll did that take on you, though, Chairman? You know, you said that you never really suffered from imposter syndrome. How did it feel, if you can recall, like, walking in there every day knowing you were the only black person out of that group of five that, like, you know, because I felt that myself. So what did you feel, or did it not matter to you?
Well, it didn't really matter because I had a position. I knew that I was prepared for it. I was going to go through the same experience. I developed relationships with each of the persons. That's been 46 years ago. Three of those people I'm still close to, and I still know. I ran for office for the first time for school board here locally in 1994. One of those individuals hosted a party for me at her house and invited folk to come over to support me. One of them, we carpooled together to work every day and still check in with each other periodically. So while being the only one, at the time I started at Intergon, for example, there were five black men who worked there, two of whom were maintenance workers. There was only one, I would say, that would be in sort of an executive position that was head of the finance area, and myself, and I can't recall right now the fifth one. So I was aware of it and conscious of it, but in terms of a feeling of something that impeded me moving forward or continuing to press forward, I never really felt that part of it.
I think there's something
that you mentioned that is interesting. So like the person that said to you, I need for you to tell me because I have a privilege that prevents me from understanding where you might be coming from or what I'm doing or what the impact is. That can also happen with a relationship that you've had for a long time. I have a friend who's white, who's a moderate Republican. I've known him for 25 years. We can talk about anything at any time. He's just written a book that I wrote the introduction for. However, 25 years later, and this has been within the last couple of months, he made a comment to me that all of a sudden he had an aha experience about something I said to him many years ago. And the point I made to him was, you know, John, I can still go back to where I used to live, which is the east side of Winston-Salem and 23rd Street below Jackson. And I can still hang with the brothers and sisters who live there. I can talk in the language of the people that I grew up with. And at the same time, I can go into the boardroom or into a meeting and conduct myself in a way accordingly with what's going on. And to a certain extent, that's a different language. It's bilingual, as we use the term. We can go in and out, and we know how to change. He saw something recently with me where that happened, and all of a sudden it was kind of like bingo. It's like the scales fell off his eyes, and he finally realized something that we've talked about or that I shared with him many years ago. So sometimes it takes time. It's also frustrating because you can tell people something and they don't understand it and they don't see it and they haven't experienced it before and they don't know that intrinsic bias that they have because they haven't had the experience. We've seen it from a different point of view, and we've had to be a part of what they are part of, and so we know it. Our antenna goes up very quickly when certain things happen that they don't think twice about.
No, that's so real, Chairman. I keep reflecting back on Blackish. You know, I like watch Blackish. My wife and I, we have a few shows. I don't really watch too much TV, but my wife and I, there are a few shows that we watch together. And I never forget watching Blackish, and she was in the hospital. And, you know, Rainbow likes to, she likes to state that she's a doctor, right? And one thing that she does when she states that she's a doctor, she was in the hospital, and one of her fellow doctors were like, oh, you went to, she said, yeah, I went to USC. And he was like, oh, you went to USC? And he said it, like, with this question, like, oh, wow. And she interpreted, he kept saying it, like, he interpreted it to me, like, oh, you're good enough to get into USC. USC is one of the top medical schools on the West Coast. And it just always, in my opinion, I think sometimes when you deal with individuals and you deal with bias, whether it's, you know, straightforward or if it's even, you know, covert, I think that it takes a tone. I mean, it takes a piece of you, you know? And I think that that's one of the burdens of being Black, that you have to, there's always this thought that you have to be twice as good. Did anyone ever say that to you? You have to be twice as good, you know?
That's something that you grew up understanding, that's always been told, that you have to be twice as good. So you recognize that, and you keep pushing forward. You know, I was looking at a clip of Michael Jordan. I don't know if you've been looking at the docuseries that's currently going on, which is outstanding. But I was looking mm-hmm. at a clip of his Hall of Fame speech a couple of days ago. And one of the things, if you have the opportunity to look at that or your listeners look at it, one of the things you'll find out about Michael is that he used those moments as inspiration to prove people that they were wrong. And it could be anything. It could be someone saying, I'm going to shut you down tonight, and that just pushed them to a different level. Or it could be someone that says, you're retired, and if you ever come back and put on shorts, I'm going to take you to the hoop. And he put the shorts on, and he took them to the hoop, and he's still ready to do it. So I have felt it, but it's a certain motivation to demonstrate that you can do it in spite of what's happening or what someone says. I mean, in that situation that you just shared, it's really what someone is doing that they may be unaware, and they could be aware of it, is they're surprised because you're Black that you went to this particular place or that you got in. And so what we hear in the voice is, why are you surprised? You know, it's like someone shared with me once a long time ago. I spoke someplace. I don't recall whether it was a church or some other event. And this person came up to me afterwards and told me, oh, you speak so well. And I'm thinking to myself, so what did you think I was going to do?
Yep.
I mean, I understand how the subject and verb is supposed to connect. You know, I can put a coherent sentence together. I can have some content that actually makes sense. So why are you surprised? I mean, are you surprised because I'm Black? Are you surprised because I'm a male? Are you surprised because why? What's, I don't understand that. Or, as you're aware, I wrote a column for the Winston-Salem Chronicle and the Journal for a long time, and there would be someone to say, man, I really love your articles. Did you write them yourself? What do you mean did I write them myself?
Oh,
my
man,
picture is there, and my name is there. So did you think they just put my picture and name and someone else wrote it and then they put the words in? I mean, and so for me, I don't know how to play poker, but I would not be a good poker player because my face reveals what I'm thinking at the time, and I have to sort of put that in check and measure it because what I'm thinking is, you must be crazy. What's wrong with you?
Kevin, that is so interesting that you say that. I think that I indeed would be a terrible poker player because I have a very, very hard time hiding my internal feelings on my face. I do wear my emotions on my sleeve, and I think that's something that I've been trying to grow in professionally. Because I probably would have lost it. I probably would have lost it on someone. Because I mean, it just happens, in my opinion, all too often where people have to think through things. Like, I think that's part of the imposter syndrome as well, though, right? I think that fuels, stuff like that fuels it. And there are some people who are not nearly as strong, you know, as you are, And I think through some of the individuals I've spoken to on the podcast, but even just some of the friends in my professional career that we, you know, come across and have these conversations, one thing that we always talk about is the fact of feeling less than, and like those microaggressions. Those exactly what they are. They're like microaggressions where people, you know, they're putting out these darts at you, saying like, "Oh, you spoke so well." Like, you know what? It's no one ever told you that it is, you know, rude to tell black people that, you know, you don't speak well, especially considering the context that initially, you know, we were inferior and like, you know, less intelligent. So I think all of those things feed into that. They feed into that, and they create this experience where people have to constantly like stand up for themselves. Let me ask you this question on a personal note, Chairman. You know, have you ever at your job, have you ever been accused of being intimidating?
More so because of my size than mm-hmm. anything else. I think those that know me know that I am not. There are times in terms of tone of voice or posture that may come across in that way. Work-related, not really so, and that may be just how I carry myself. You know, back to your point earlier, and I was just listening to you, and as we're having this conversation now, I thought about it a little bit more. Part of the burden, I think, comes from knowing that you have to manage these things, and you're keeping some of that in or maintaining your posture, and that can be a burden for some. So outwardly, someone may not know it because you've decided to manage it in a way and to hold it in. But as you know, I can throw darts at you only so long before something erupts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's going to come a time when that happens. Now, when that happens, it may be with someone that had nothing to do with when it started, but that's the person that it comes out. And the way they see that is, it's something they did or it's directed at them when it's the accumulation of a lot of things that have happened over a long period of time. You know, I had a person, I went through leadership once in Salem back in 1992, and Dr. Charles King was a professor. He was also a minister, and he led a race and gender class for leadership. He was a big black man, and He used an analogy of an alpha cessor. Now, some of the folk like you on the line may not know what an alpha cessor is because that predates your time, right? But it's a little tablet that you would break up.
Chairman, I know what an alpha cessor is.
I don't know. You know, you're millennial, man. You know, you might not know some of it. It's like you haven't had the experience with that big wall phone with that long cord on it running all the way across the house. So.
No, that's true.
He used the experience of an alpha cessor, and the commercial used to be plop, plop, fizz, fizz, because you break it up, you put it in water, and it sort of sizzles, and eventually it dissipates, and the water looks clear. And his whole point was these microaggressions or these darts that you mentioned happen. So something happens today, and it fizzes, and it looks clear, so it looks like Terrell is okay. And then 2 months later, you go to Dallas, and something happens. And it dissipates, and the water looks clear, so Terrell is all right. And then sometime later, you go someplace else or the workplace. And eventually one day, that last piece of alka-seltzer or that incident goes in, and it just boils over. And you lash out or you respond in a way that they don't understand. And it isn't so much what just happened as it is what has happened over some time, and this was just the one that just pushed you over the edge. And so many people don't understand that and don't recognize a particular majority community, which then fuels or reinforces a perception that they already have that's been fed by media that has been one-sided for too long.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a burden. Anyway, this friend that I mentioned to you that I've known for 25 years, that's white, and it's a moderate Republican. We were having a conversation with someone in leadership a long time ago, a few years ago, about race relations, and I was sharing things that I thought we needed to do and what we were avoiding. And afterwards, he made a comment to me that, you know, I haven't quite seen you that way before. You know, it was a different tone of voice. It was a different passion. So he recognized that something was different, but it really wasn't different. It was always there. He just saw it in a different light at that particular time. And so many of the majority community just has not either internalized some of the experiences that we tried to share in a way that they became more conscious. So to me, intellectually, having a conversation is different than having a conversation that moves to your heart that makes you more conscious. If I can get it to move to a different place, move to your heart where you feel it and are conscious, you can't be the same after that. And I don't think that happens with too many. Yes, still here.
I think that's real. Kevin, you said something. You said that that, you know, you think that part of you being intimidating to individuals may be a result of, you know, your size and your demeanor, your stature. One thing that I think through is I had a conversation with a gentleman who is, you know, diminutive in stature, colossal in intelligence, but
right.
yet diminutive in stature, right? And this is, yeah, he's a black man, older black man. And he told me recently, you know, he works in the legal field. He told me recently that individuals refer to him as intimidating. And this is interesting because, you know, I was diving deep, you know, I was diving deep into, you know, the Ahmaud, the run with Ahmaud, the movement that's going on in the case in Brunswick, Georgia. Because that slapped me like a ton of brick for a few reasons. I think reason number one, you know, I'm a black man. Reason number two, I run. Like, I'm a runner, you know. And I run at night. I run at night. The other night, what's it, Wednesday night? Tuesday night, you know, I ran a midnight 5K. And I happened to be, like, running, and I realized that, like, hey, it's 12 o'clock. In my neighborhood, you know, in my complex, there are only like five black people. And I was like, what am I doing running at 12 o'clock as a black man? You know what I mean? And like, I routinely run at night, but like, it just had me thinking through the fact that no matter who I am, what job I have, how much money I make, like, I'm not immune to like being seen as a threat, being seen as a black man. And so I turned around, called one of my friends who's also a runner, and I turned around and I went home. And it just makes me think about the additional burdens that an additional weight that sometimes we have to carry going through this world, going through this life. And I think that it's important that people know. One of the reasons I started this podcast because, like I stated, I've almost always been the only one. And that's someone's own sense of weight. You know, you and I have talked many a nights about some of the weight that I've had to carry and like and needing help thinking through it. And I wanted to say to you, you know, I have a few white friends who sometimes ask me like, how can we make this better, right? Like, how can we be allies? I wanted to know from you, do you have like climbing the ladder that you have climbed, getting to the areas that you've gotten in your life professionally, what sort of allies did you have, and how did they help you be successful in life? White allies, that is. Maybe people professionally at the job where things happened that shouldn't have happened and they stood up for you. Do you have any examples of that?
Well, there's one person in particular who happened to be, after I went through the management trainee program that I went through was a year long and rotated around in different areas. And at the end of that period of time, then you chose an area in the company where you would start working. So my first position was in our life insurance company as an underwriter. And one of those individuals would have been Bob Girard. Bob was the vice president of underwriting I had a supervisor, but he was the person over the entire department. And I remember, I never forget that he called me into his office one day. And he sat me down and he just looked at me and said, "What the hell is going on?" And the issue was I had a backlog of cases because I was uncertain of making a decision or making a bad decision. Therefore, my caseload was backing up. And so he said to me rather directly, "You know, we're going to divide this out. We're going to get you caught up." And he also knew that I had an interest in being involved in the community. And I'll never forget what he said to me. And he said, "As long as you do what you need to do here, you can do whatever you want to do out there. And you tell me what it is you want to do, and I will help you do that." So for me, that was an ally. That was very affirming. One, there was help. Two, there was some guidance in terms of what do you want to do, and I'll tell you or show you or help you do that. And as long as you perform like you should, you can do whatever you want to do out here in terms of engagement. So he is one person specifically that had a major part in assisting me early, the second year out of college in my career. In addition to that, you know, there have been a number of people who have provided opportunities, invitations to participate and engage in civic organizations, whether it was Kiwanis, clubs, or things of that nature. And so they have extended invitations to come and be a part of it. And then the process starts over again. You start meeting other people, developing relationships, becoming involved, and one thing leads to another. So, yes, there have been several situations where that has happened.
I think that's important because it's important for individuals to know that they can use their privilege to help out and to stand in the gap. I remember when we were in Ferguson protesting the death of Michael Brown, one thing that we saw white allies do is they got on the front line because they knew that they had a lot more social cachet. So when police came, you know, the police were less likely to, like, hit and throw people in jail initially because it was white people at the front, right? And we've seen that happen all across. I think in professional settings, you know, when things have been wrong or lacking in equity, I've seen white people stand up and say, "You know what? Like, actually, it doesn't make sense that all the people who are in support positions or admin positions at this organization are people of color." You know what I mean? And very few people in leadership positions at this organization are people of color. Like, that balance seems out of line to me, right? And I think oftentimes you may hear black people or other people of color mention that, and it sometimes gets brushed away, right? But when other individuals say it, people may give it more credence. And that's not right. It's not right at all. But I think what we have to do is learn how to use the systems and tools that we have to affect change. And it makes you think about that quote from Audre Lorde, that the master tools will never dismantle the master power. And so that's something that I've always tried to keep in mind. I have one final question for you, Chairman, and I think that this is probably one of the most important ones. Like, what would you say to younger black professionals who are where you once was, right? They may be fighting to make a name for themselves as one of the few or only people of color at their organization. And what advice do you have for them?
Well, there are a number of things. I jotted down several responses to that. One is to be prepared. I recall when I pledged fraternity, I know you have another fraternity, all good. I was the only one on my line with 30-plus big brothers. And at that time, it was a different day in terms of pledging, in terms of the experience. And what I decided at that time was I'm going to do everything that I'm supposed to do and know everything I'm supposed to know. So if something happens other than what I think should happen, I know it's because you just wanted to do it. My point with that is just being prepared for whatever it is, for the task, the content, the expertise, the knowledge that you need to have. It's an ongoing process. Another key part I think that's important is understanding the culture that you work in. Cultures are different. Workplaces are different. You can't thrive in every culture and every workplace, and you have to understand who you are, what you're interested in, what the culture is like, and plant yourself in a place that gives you the best opportunity for you to thrive. Ongoing learning and development is key. No one knows it all. Things change rather rapidly. Forming alliances and developing relationships are very important. And that's not only within the workplace, but outside the workplace. Some of the most important relationships and alliances I had that helped me in the workplace were formed outside of the workplace that were significant for me continuing to move forward. And finally, I would say to be flexible. If you aren't flexible, you'll break. Tavis Smiley coined the term years ago when I interviewed him on a radio program I had, and he said emotional hijacking. Sometimes we're emotionally hijacked. In other words, we're caught in a moment, something happens and it grabs us, and it's over. We react. We respond in inappropriate ways, and it's understanding yourself well enough to know what those triggers are to respond versus reacting. And then just to leverage the rules of the game. I think you just mentioned that earlier. This is a game. If you don't know it's a game, you're going to lose. The game has rules. If you don't know the rules, you can't play by the rules. And even though you play by them, sometimes you still don't win. But once you understand them and you leverage them to your advantage, it just puts you in a better position. So those would be some of the things. And then seek out people that know more than you do, and develop that network that is supportive of you. You may have read the book Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, and in it there's a concept that he calls the mastermind group. And that's just a very small group of people that you trust that have your well-being and that will assist you. So it's having, whether you call it a mastermind group or a small group of booger-nosed friends, or a small group of people that you can trust and reach out to and share things with, and you know they have your best interests at heart, that will help you through whatever situation happens to come up in terms of how to respond or how to navigate. Sometimes that means leaving where you are. Sometimes it means staying and doing something in a different way. You and I have had many, 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 many conversations. I remember one of the first ones we had when you were a senior at Winston-Salem State University. You were president of SGA. As such, you were the student representative on the Board of Trustees, where I was the chair.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a situation where you were not being allowed to speak at graduation because of something that had happened. And it really just had to do with the attitude of the person who was the chancellor at that time, not wanting you to do it because of him more so than you. We had I think we went to Applebee's one night prior to graduation to have a conversation. I gave you some advice, what I suggested you would do. You had a very strong feeling about what you were going to do, which is what you did, but you didn't have the opportunity to speak. Now, what you did was different than what I would have done. However, you listened, you took in the information, and as I've always told you and will continue to, here's what I suggest, but you have to make the decision. And from those decisions, you begin to learn and mature, and eventually you may make some different decisions. So those would be a few things that I would suggest to someone who may be at the beginning or at a similar situation that I was in or you have been in before to help navigate through some of those things, and eventually, as you continue to drink out that well, that you'll be able to pass that on to someone else to help them come along. So, in so many words, the baton has been passed, and now you're doing what others have done for you.
Jim, I wanna say thank you, number one, for those wise words that I'm sure the listeners will be able to hold on to as they're going through their particular issues and navigating their jobs and their experiences. I want to thank you personally for jumping on the podcast. You know, it's an honor to have you on this podcast. The conversations we have, albeit late at night, for the conversations we have are always highlights, and I always leave better than when I came. So I'm exceptionally thankful, honored to have you on the podcast. Thank you for jumping on. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. I'm happy that the people get a little glimpse of what I'm privileged to hold on to a lot more. So I count you as one of my most treasured relationships. So thank you again for joining the podcast.
Well, thank you, and it definitely is mutual, and I benefit as much as how you say that you benefit. So, and for those that are listening, my name is Nigel. I don't think I've ever heard Terrell call me Nigel, so it's always Mr. Chairman. So I am grateful for the relationship and the friendship over a long period of time and look forward to continuing.
Indeed, indeed. All right, have a great day. Thank you for joining.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Black Workers Experience podcast. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. If you want to hear more from me, follow me on IG at BWEPod or Twitter at BWEPodcast. Thanks, you all. Domino, only about a few blacks like I could.